You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, according to a Pew Research poll, Americans support the U.S. Postal Service a lot, but there may be big changes in the works. We talk about the potential to privatize parts of mail delivery and the search for a new Postmaster General. Now, there are a lot of ways that scientists or anyone else can find out about animal life in the wilderness. You can look around with your own eyes, set up trail cameras, but the best method may be listening. That's the sound of a rainforest recorded by a group of scientists in an effort to gauge the health of ecosystems. Our next guest has been using the sounds of rainforests in Gabon, Borneo, and elsewhere to measure the biodiversity of a given area and see how human activity, like farming and logging, can affect it. Zuzana Budovalova is an assistant professor of forest and wildlife ecology at UW-Madison and the director of the Sound Forest Lab. Zuzana, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Now, for people who haven't experienced the sound of a tropical forest, can you give us a sense of what it's like to be in the middle of that orchestra, I think you call it at one point?
Yeah, the best way to imagine it is to just close your eyes and imagine the loudest possible sound you could you could hear. It's mostly insects most times of the day. And then if you're lucky and you are in the rainforest early in the morning or just as the sun sets, you start hearing other things too, like gibbons, different other types of primates, lots of birds. It's basically a cacophony of sounds.
Now, it sounds amazing, but also it sounds scientifically useful because a lot of these animals in a forest don't want to be seen, and that makes it hard to count them. Can you talk about how sound can help us?
That's right. Especially in the rainforest, it's a little bit dark all times during the whole day because the canopy is just so thick. And a lot of the animals are small. They have other reasons to hide. They're hiding from predators. They don't really want to be hunted down by something. And that's why they rely on sounds to communicate. And they could be communicating about food, about danger. If a predator is approaching, they could be attracting their boyfriends or girlfriends. And we, as scientists, we can use that, these sounds that animals are making, to really start understanding if the animals are there, first of all, and to start learning about the forest as a whole, how healthy it is, how many different species there are. Are the species the ones that are supposed to be there, or are these some kind of new species that are coming in from other types of habitats?
Now, walk us through how you set this up. Say you're in Borneo. How do we get all the bioacoustics of these animals through the day?
The best way I find in a new place when I'm starting to record is to really record for full 24 hours, the whole day. Just because we don't know, is this particular little bird going to be singing just at 4:35 a.m. or is it going to be active through the whole day? So I would set up many, many recorders throughout the forest in some kind of systematic way and then just leave them recording. And the most important thing is that I myself leave so that the animals don't feel disturbed by a human encroaching into their habitat.
This is a lot of data. Is this something we could have done 20 years ago?
We could have certainly been recording, and many people were recording a lot of sounds in the rainforest, but most often they would just have to be there with these huge recording machines, maybe taking up a whole, you know, size of a fridge of apparatus. Nowadays, we can just take a small box, maybe the size of a small juice carton, and leave it out in the forest on its own. So the great development is we now have really good batteries. We can leave the recorders out even for, let's say, 6 months. And we have also great ways to store large amounts of data on these tiny memory cards, like exactly the same as in your camera, for example. So those are the technological developments that have allowed us to really start digging into these piles and piles, gigabytes and terabytes of data.
So you've got all this data, you've got multiple recorders, maybe over this 24-hour period. Then what? What do you do with it?
Then I try to not get overwhelmed by the huge amount of data. I first of all do some listening just to kind of check, did everything work out right? Am I hearing any animals or did some animal maybe eat the microphone and it's not going to be a good recording? And once I'm sure that the quality is right, I start processing all these terabytes of data by using different computer algorithms. And those algorithms can help us get kind of a broad picture, looking at what time of the day are the animals most active? What time are they really waking up? Like, you know, when you, for example, are camping in the summer, you get really woken up, even here in Wisconsin, at 4 or 5 a.m. And that might be the same in a rainforest, but this time might differ. So getting a broad picture first is what we do.
Do you have to go through, or your colleagues have to go through and listen and say, oh, that's that animal, that's insect, or are we at a point with the computers where they can say, oh, that's the, I mean, they don't say it, but they can mark the waveform of a particular species?
This is one of the big dreams, that one day we will just be able to feed a whole 24-hour recording to a computer and the computer will spit out all these species names and maybe even something more about the species, like were they stressed out or were they a big family of gibbons or just one lonely one. Right now, this is possible for particular species, species that people have been interested in, and they build up these algorithms to really recognize, is this, let's say, the gibbon or is it not? We don't have that for all of the species, especially in a rainforest, because oftentimes we don't even know all the species. New species are still being discovered. And I've been talking about monkeys and birds, which are relatively easy to recognize. But what about all the insects and what about all the frogs? Nobody, almost nobody, can recognize by sound all the insect species. So we're still a little far away from that.
Can you learn something by comparing and contrasting, healthy forest, healthy tropical forest versus one that's been impaired by a disaster or development or what have you?
That is exactly one scenario where using the sounds or the whole soundscapes can be incredibly useful. Because often we can look at a forest, let's say using a satellite picture, satellite image taken from the space, and we could see, okay, is the forest still there or is it gone? Did somebody cut it down? Did the forest burn down? But we don't really see from those satellite images whether the forest is healthy. Does it have healthy animals? Does it have all the species it's supposed to have? And that's exactly where we can use bioacoustics almost as a stethoscope, like a doctor would use. We can try to listen to the vital signs of the forest and realize, is the forest maybe recovering after human presence or human exploitation, or is it getting even worse?
Oh, another thought, we have invasive species here in Wisconsin, and I think you touched on this earlier. Is this something that could help detect something that is not where it's supposed to be, something that could be destructive in a forest setting?
Definitely, invasive species could be detected by bioacoustics if they vocalize. Unfortunately, a lot of the invasive species that we have problems with here in Wisconsin are plants, and plants obviously don't vocalize, or for example, some kinds of ants. And those can be harder to track down with bioacoustics. But if we were talking about an invasive species of frog, which does happen, especially in some tropical regions, bioacoustics might be a good way to detect them.
You've done this research so far in, I think, Borneo, Papua New Guinea, and Gabon. Why start there? Why those areas in particular?
Those areas, Gabon, Papua New Guinea, and Borneo, are, for me, absolutely fascinating. I just, every time I even think about them, I get so excited. There's so many different species of animals, plants, even just the whole ecosystem is very, very biodiverse. And at the same time, they're under incredible threat of deforestation, of hunting, of all the different things that we humans do to the forests. Climate change is also going to be impacting how animals in these forests do. So that's why these three regions have been the focus of my work, because they kind of are the absolutely most diverse and the most threatened at the same time.
What kind of questions in these areas you work in are you hoping in the future that bioacoustics really helps you and your colleagues tackle?
One question that I would love to be able to answer is, how does taking the timber out of these forests, kind of in a selective way, you just take one tree here and there and make a nice piece of furniture out of it, how does that impact all the different animal species? And can we hear that in the soundscapes? Because I think if we can measure really, really precisely how animals are being impacted by logging, we can then adapt the logging practices to make it better for biodiversity. And at the same time, we could bring to people who are buying that piece of furniture, we can show them where exactly that piece of wood has come from. We can play them the sounds. And that way, people might also become more aware of what it is that they're actually buying.
And as we wrap up, you went into this field of forest and wildlife ecology. Did you imagine when you first started that it would be a high-tech computer audio experiment too?
I did not imagine that I would be working with audio, but I definitely knew that it's important to always explore new technologies. So I started off by using drones, actually.
Really?
Trying to take aerial video and images. And that's because I was always aware that the current ways we have of measuring biodiversity are not necessarily good enough for the types of massive and urgent conservation questions we are facing. We really need to throw everything we have to solve the conservation crisis.
Susanna, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having me.
Susanna Budovalova is an assistant professor of forest and wildlife ecology at UW-Madison and the director of the Sound Forest Lab. She talked with us about her work with bioacoustics, measuring the diversity of animal life in rainforests around the world with sound recordings. Coming up next, 90% of Americans polled by Pew Research Center have a favorable view of the U.S. Postal Service, but our next guest says it is time for some maybe substantial changes. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the U.S. Senate began the opening stages of its impeachment trial of the president earlier today. We'll catch up on what they've said and done so far. Now, a 2019 Pew Research poll found that the U.S. Postal Service was the most favored federal agency by the public, ranking just above national parks and then NASA. 90% of people polled had a positive view of the Postal Service. But the USPS is and has been struggling in many ways. The last 13 years have brought continual debt, and the post office is on track to run out of money, by one estimate, by 2024. To add to the picture, the current Postmaster General is delaying her retirement while the search for her successor continues. There's been talk of privatizing parts of the Postal Service by the Trump administration. Rick Geddes is a professor of policy analysis and management at Cornell University and director of the Cornell Program in Infrastructure Policy. Rick, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for inviting me, Rob.
Can you talk about some of the challenges facing the U.S. Postal Service in recent years?
Yeah, sure. So there are several challenges. One is that the U.S. Postal Service has a high and fairly fixed cost structure. And by that, Rob, I mean that the United States Postal Service is required to deliver mail to just about every address in the United States 6 days a week. And it has to maintain a big delivery network. In order to meet that, that's called the universal service obligation. But on the other side of the equation, Rob, is the revenues that the Postal Service gets from its most profitable businesses, which are first class mail, and that's cards and letters, has been dropping over time. So you've got revenues falling. At the same time, it has this high and pretty rigid cost structure, and that leads to, you know, fiscal troubles, let's say. So the Postal Service losses in its fiscal 2019 year were about $9 billion, which was more than double the loss in the prior year.
We've seen those net losses. In 2006, a lot of people point to this. The U.S. Postal Service was required to pre-fund health care for future retirees. And some supporters of the Postal Service say that's an obligation that other agencies and other businesses don't have. Is that a part of the story here for these annual shortfalls?
Well, you know, you have to be careful when you talk about businesses. And, you know, certainly private businesses have to cover the costs of their own employees, and you know, with the retiree pre-funding is what they call it. It's for their retiree healthcare costs. It's useful to think of it. Somebody has to cover that cost, and it's either going to be paid by the ratepayers, that is, the big mailers that are using the Postal Service. And if you look at your own mail coming in, it's almost never a individual card or letter. It's usually big advertisers. Or is that going to be paid by taxpayers, right? So you have to think about which one is the more appropriate group. Under the current system, that's being covered more by ratepayers. And, you know, in my view, it's better for that to be covered by the mailers who are actually using the Postal Service than the general taxpayer.
Right. How much taxpayer money goes into the Postal Service currently?
Well, it's actually that's a good question, Rob. It's hard to calculate exactly that. I mean, they have a $15 billion essentially credit card with the Treasury, and that is maxed out, right? So they're in debt to the United States Treasury. There's also other ways that taxpayers, you know, help to subsidize Postal Service operations. They own a ton of land in the form of local post offices, sorting centers, et cetera, you know, and don't pay property taxes on that. There's certain regulations that don't apply, et cetera. So, you know, it's a lot of money, getting at least $15 billion, but getting it absolute number accurately is pretty tough.
Right. There isn't like a budget line like the Department of Defense where there's an allocation from Congress annually for the post office. Is that right?
No. So that's interesting, Rob. Back, you know, it used to be you just used the term post office, right? And now we call it the U.S. Postal Service. That change actually occurred in the 1970 Act, the Postal Reorganization Act, that created the new U.S. Postal Service out of the old post office. And prior to that, there was a budget line item, you know, to cover the cost of the post office, just like there was for the Department of Defense or something like that. But in the 1970 Act, the new Postal Service was supposed to cover all of its costs through the rates and fees that it charges to mailers. So, you know, it's kind of this break-even constraint that was imposed on the Postal Service ever since 1970. And, you know, that the idea was it was supposed to operate more like a commercial business ever since that time.
Talking to Rick Geddes from Cornell University about the U.S. Postal Service struggles in funding in recent years and the future. Now, let's look at we've got a Postmaster General, Megan Brennan, on her way out, retiring. I think supposed to be done by now, delaying it as they search. How does one pick a new Postmaster General?
Well, you know, I think, Rob, the challenges facing the Postal Service today are very different than they were before. I mean, most people know that, you know, electronic communications has really taken a bite out of the Postal Service. In fact, first-class mail volume peaked in 2001. So that's been, and that's their most profitable class. That's some time ago. It's declined by over a third, well over a third since that time. So somebody is going to have to come in there who's really going to be able to manage the Postal Service in a more commercial way. And, you know, take it. I think privatization is extreme, if by that they mean actually selling it, which is the accurate use of that term, as opposed to things like commercializing it and deregulating it, which is what most other posts around the world have done. That means reducing the monopoly power. So there's actually a legally mandated monopoly over the delivery of anything defined as a letter. But also, you know, the Postal Service has a number of other regulatory benefits, but also regulatory constraints. So I think getting it to operate more like a regular business, maybe adjusting the delivery days per week, if Congress would allow that, to help the Postal Service manage through this this transition, really.
And we've talked to you about these issues in the past, and even these little tweaks around the edges, like cutting back on a day of delivery or anything like that, it gets a lot of pushback. Is this politically hard to do, to change the way our postal system operates?
Rob, it's extremely hard to do. The Postal Service has asked Congress for permission to cut back. I think, you know, the lightest mail day of the week is actually Tuesday. So it would make sense to, you know, cut off Tuesday delivery as mail volumes decline, maybe Tuesday and Thursday, delivering 3 days a week, et cetera. or I should say a minimum of 3 days a week. Postal Service could deliver more days a week, right, if it wanted to, but that would ease up this universal service obligation that I mentioned and allow the Postal Service to, you know, to save some costs, which is critical in light of these revenue declines that I mentioned.
One angle that's a little newer for the USPS is the Amazon factor. The USPS does a lot of delivery for Amazon. The president has been critical of the rates they charge in their current deal with Amazon. How does that factor into all of this?
Yeah, well, that's a big issue, Rob. And it's, you know, there's a big question of to what degree parcel delivery in general, not just for Amazon, but parcels in general, are, you know, covering their what we call marginal cost, which is the cost of delivering that package, plus some contribution, you know, to the whole Postal Service system. And so, you know, economists like me want those rates that they charge for parcel delivery to be accurate. And there's a big debate about whether those costs are properly allocated to parcels. Clearly, you know, it's helped the Postal Service, I think, to have that parcel delivery increase. But, you know, really it's bread and butter is the delivery of what we call first class mail and then standard mail. And standard mail is really the advertising materials like catalogs and things like that. So, you know, if those core businesses are declining the way we've seen, you're going to have to undertake some major reforms to have the Postal Service survive.
Rick, a lot to watch here. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Rob. Thanks for having me.
That's Rick Geddes, professor of policy analysis and management at Cornell University and director of the Cornell Program in Infrastructure Policy. He joins us to talk about the U.S. Postal Service, their search for a new Postmaster General, and what options they might have for the future. Not privatization, he thinks, but maybe some different commercial looks, changes to the way they operate coming in the future. Coming up, we'll get the latest on today's opening of the Senate impeachment trial of President Trump and what to watch for in the days ahead. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 6 on The Morning Show, Kate Archer-Kent talks to the author of the new book, The Meritocracy Trap, who says we're fooling ourselves if we think we live in a merit-based society. It's tomorrow morning at 6 here on the Ideas Network. Now we've arrived at the next phase of President Donald Trump's impeachment. Today, the Senate gaveled in for its trial of the president, weighing the House's two articles of impeachment. Before the trial can really begin, however, they have to resolve the logistics of how much time each side will receive to make their case, along with other ground rules for the process. Susan Johnson is an associate professor of political science at UW-Whitewater and director there of the Center for Political Science and Public Policy Research. Susan, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
We're at this process stage, which is kind of fascinating in a lot of ways. What kind of things are striking you about what kind of rules they're arguing about before we get into the trial proper?
Well, they're arguing about how long each side will have to offer their arguments and in what type of format will it be in terms of, you know, how compressed will it be in terms of time. They're speaking right now about, you know, getting their hands on some documents, and they'll be speaking later about witnesses and things like that. So today is very much the day to set the ground rules for the trial moving forward.
And Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell had said 24 hours for each side to initially present their cases. At first, that was going to be over a two-day span, so that's 12 hours a day. That's been changed now to three session days for those 24 hours, again, for each side. That initial plan, 12-hour days for 2 days for each side, got some criticism for kind of trying to pack too much in. What did you think of that initial proposal, Susan?
Yeah, there were two things that came out yesterday in the proposed rules for what was going to happen. And one of them was this idea that there would be just 24 hours, like you said, for each side over 2 days each. And the hearings convene at 1 p.m. Eastern. So at minimum, we'd be talking about going till 1 a.m., but likely quite past that on those days. And so that was one thing. And then the second thing that was in his resolution originally was that the materials and evidence that had been collected by the House would not automatically become part of the Senate trial. And so that was interesting to me as well, because people were saying, well, what's the basis then if the evidence that had been collected by the House does not just automatically kind of move over to the Senate? And then in the resolution that was introduced today by the Senate, penciled in or penned in were these changes, one of which was accepting the evidence from the House. And then secondly, it was changing the time limits or the duration from 2 12-hour days per side to apparently 3 8-hour days per side.
Now, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell is in a unique role for a Senate Majority Leader. This doesn't come up very often. What do you see pushing and pulling on him in this initial rules process?
Well, it's interesting because he's managing the Senate, leading the Senate, and trying to make sure that he can keep his majority voting with him. He has 53 votes in the Senate, so he can't lose more than a couple on any given vote. So he's got that audience. And then he has the audience of the president, who's watching from afar, but watching, I would assume, with a keen eye and trying to direct things through his legal team. And then there's the public that's watching. So Mitch McConnell, I would say, is trying to balance all three of those. And, I mean, so far, I think, you know, throughout this process, he's done it. But now we'll see what happens as we start taking these votes.
Talking to Susan Johnson from UW-Whitewater about some of the latest steps in the impeachment process before the U.S. Senate. One big question is whether we'll hear about witnesses and when the idea of voting for witnesses might be voted on. Now, from the House, we had a Democrat, Adam Schiff, talking to the Senate today. Here is him talking about one particular witness that's getting a lot of attention, John Bolton.
He's willing to come and testify and tell you what he knows. The question is, do you want to hear it? Do you want to hear it? Do you want to hear from someone who was in the meetings, someone who described what the president did, this deal between Mulvaney and Sondland as a drug deal? Do you want to know why it was a drug deal? Do you want to ask him why it was a drug deal? Do you want to ask him why he repeatedly told people, go talk to the lawyers? You should want to know. They don't want you to know. They don't want you to know. The president doesn't want you to know. Can you really live up to the oath you've taken to be impartial and not know? I don't think you can.
A lot of the suspense here, Susan, is whether we'll hear from John Bolton, whether it'll be public testimony. If so, what is the latest on the process of how to decide whether he or other witnesses might come before the Senate?
Well, part of what we're hearing today and what I think we're going to be hearing later is that the Democrats are arguing that they want to have votes on whether or not to subpoena certain documents and then also have witnesses. And they want to include those as part of the organizing resolution. And what Majority Leader McConnell is saying is that we're not going to be dealing with those issues now, and we will address those issues down the road. And that was when he moved to table the prior amendment that they were debating. He did so by arguing that these issues should not be debated now, but they should be debated down the road. And that's the case he's making as far as whether or not there should be witnesses or not.
Bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. John is with us in Neenah. John, hi.
Yes, sir. How are you doing?
Good. What did you want to bring up, John?
Yeah, that the President of the United States is an employee of the American people. Therefore, John Bolton is an employee of the American people, and he should be made to testify publicly.
John, thanks for the call. And when it was before the House, Susan, there was the question of executive privilege. The president had ordered a lot of people not to testify before the House. Could the same thing happen in the Senate, even if the Senate wants to hear from people like John Bolton?
The president could make a claim of executive privilege. One of the interesting debates that we've heard has to do with what exactly is executive privilege and how exactly can a president invoke it. And what's unique to the Trump administration is that there have been blanket assertions of executive privilege in ways that we've not seen necessarily in the past. And so with someone like John Bolton, for example, there certainly might be areas where the president has a legitimate claim of executive privilege, but historically those are addressed more on a case-by-case basis as opposed to this idea of just kind of from afar saying, I'm invoking executive privilege and you can't even show up and be part of the proceeding. So that was part of the argument that was being made this morning by the president's lawyers as well in terms of arguing in favor of executive privilege.
We're talking to UW-Whitewater Associate Professor of Political Science Susan Johnson about the impeachment trial that got underway in the Senate today. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you listened to or watched the coverage for part of the day, all day? What have your impressions been? What do you think about the timeline that Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell proposed in his resolution? Do you want to see witnesses? Should there be more documents provided to the Senate? Should new information that's come out since the House impeachment process be part of the Senate process now? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about the impeachment trial of President Trump underway today in the Senate. Susan Johnson is with us, political scientist at UW-Whitewater, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the process and what we know about it so far? What do you want to see happen? Do you want to see more witnesses come before the Senate that maybe didn't speak before the House for one reason or another? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go back to your calls now. Rob is with us in Winona, Minnesota. Rob, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Rob?
Well, I think the Republicans have to walk a tightrope here. They need to keep Trump in office because, let's face it, if he's out, Mike Pence can't win the next election. However, the trial here can't look so much like a whitewash that it hampers them in the next election.
Rob, thanks a lot for the call. Susan, what do you think about that tightrope Rob is talking about there for Republicans?
Well, I mean, I think in particular, there's certain Republican members of the Senate who are running for re-election who are even walking a more narrow tightrope in that someone, for example, like Susan Collins of Maine, we've heard her named quite a bit, Cory Gardner in Colorado and others who are in what we consider to be more purple states who have significant percentages of the population who might not even be in favor of removing him from office, but do want to see the trial appear as open and, you know, inclusive or fair as possible. And so I think they're especially walking a tightrope.
Rob, thanks a lot for the call at 800-642-1234. Gerald joins us next in Sturgeon Bay. Gerald, hello.
Hi. My quick question is this. If the president's being impeached for his pro quo thing, Joe Biden admitted that he did this. Now, why is we going to go through another impeachment right away if he gets elected? Or should he not be allowed to keep running for president?
Gerald, thanks for the call. Susan, you want to sort out what the president is accused of versus Joe Biden's pressure on Ukraine when it came to a prosecutor there?
As I understand it, Joe Biden's work was part of an international effort to have more investigations going on in regard to corruption in Ukraine. The president's is more specific to withholding aid, and the charges against the president are for obstructing Congress. And So there's a distinction there, and but I think another point that Gerald makes is an interesting one is, are we going to see more frequent impeachments moving forward? And I don't know the answer to that.
Gerald, thanks for the call. Another issue I wanted to get into, Susan, is information that's come out since the House process and since the House voted to impeach and whether or not it'll be included before the Senate. We have the letter from Rudy Giuliani as, in his capacity as the president's personal lawyer to the president of Ukraine, making it clear he's representing the president as a person, not as the leader of the United States. And then Lev Parnas, who is an associate of Giuliani, saying lots of stuff, really, and putting a lot of things out there. Is that going to end up being part of what the Senate considers here?
You know, it still remains to be seen. My hunch is that a lot of that will not become part of what the Senate sees. And I think a lot of those debates are going to happen after the opening statements. And once opening statements are complete, there can be, and there likely will be, a motion by some Republican in the Senate to have a vote at, to dismiss. And that might be the end of it. But I think that the Democrats are going to push really hard to get as much new material as possible. But the response from the Republicans to this point has been, why didn't you bring it up before? Which isn't necessarily an honest argument, because a lot of it's new, as you mentioned.
And let's talk about what could go on in the House. Some people have said if the Senate doesn't do things like talk to John Bolton or Lev Parnas, the House could try subpoenaing more people and have parallel hearings going on while the impeachment is going on. And, of course, that information would get to the senators, even if they're not talking to them directly. Do you think that's something that might be happening?
That's a really interesting question. And I've heard other people say that they could keep impeaching the president as well if the House wants to do that. I don't know that Speaker Pelosi has a lot of interest in continuing this, but absolutely, particularly if it ends without any witnesses and if it ends in a sort of a summary resolution to dismiss, I could see the House wanting to bring some of these people in to at least have more testimony to get this out there to the public in a more formal way. So Parnas, like you said, he's been interviewed all over, you know, news, but having him in front of the Senate and providing this information does air another level of formality to it that the House might want to see.
Let's bring on one more caller. Julie is with us in Appleton. Julie, hi.
Hello there. Thank you for taking my call. It's just a quick comment. Regardless if you're a Republican, a Democrat, an independent, or somewhere else along the spectrum, I just feel that it's imperative that this trial be an actual trial, and the majority of Americans see it as an actual open trial, and everything is looked at, because if it's not, the bar has been moved drastically for a future president as far as conduct in office and not being held responsible.
Interesting, Julie. Thanks a lot for the call. Susan, I think she's addressing the legitimacy of the Senate trial process. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, and I think that Julie's right in the sense that, as I mentioned earlier, there's a lot of people that just want to see the process appear as transparent and comprehensive as possible. And they might not all even favor removal, but the idea that this might somehow be swept under the rug or certain evidence not be shared is just seen as inappropriate. And therefore, they want to have things aired much more publicly and much more broadly.
Thanks for the call, Julie. On a side note, as we wrap up, Susan, some interesting rules in the Senate. No cell phones. They can't be looking at their phones and tweeting and things like that during this trial. And I believe I saw the only beverages allowed are milk and water on the Senate floor during this. This is a different kind of a special occasion for the U.S. Senate with some weird little rules thrown in.
It is, and I heard that Mitch McConnell was caught on a mic instructing the senators that when the Chief Justice enters, they are to rise. And so, yeah, it's very different and something that they're not used to. And I'm guessing a lot of them are chafing under the no computer, you know, no snacks rules. I know I probably would.
And in just a few moments, what is the next big decision you're really watching for, Susan, that could drop to as early as tonight?
Well, I'm just watching for the vote on these additional amendments. And from what I understand, there's going to be an amendment introduced on witnesses, which we'll lose, and then we'll move forward. So there's not going to be any big wins for the Democrats, I don't think.
Susan, thanks for joining us. We can both enjoy a glass of milk and or water now.
Absolutely. Thanks.
That's Susan Johnson, Associate Professor of Political Science at UW-Whitewater, Director of UW-Whitewater's Center for Political Science and Public Policy Research. We talked to her today about the beginning of the Senate trial of Donald Trump today in the nation's capital. Tune in each afternoon at 4:30 on Central Time. We'll recap what's going on in the Senate impeachment trial. You can hear the live coverage of those proceedings, if you'd like, on WPR's News and Classical Music Network or online at WPR.org. In the last two decades, dozens of Wisconsin school districts have retired their Native American mascots. As the Statewide Association of School Boards considers the issue this week, a Native American man who portrayed his school's mascot more than 50 years ago says it's time to put an end to all such images. Rob Mentzer has more.
Of all the images of Native Americans in the Bittersweet Winds exhibit, the mascot suit stands out. It's 6.5 feet tall with bright red skin and features so exaggerated that it barely looks human.
We call him Wolfman, and to me, this is the most racist item in the exhibit.
Richie Plass is the curator of this exhibit, and this showing at the Shawnee Community High School is a homecoming for him. In 1968, when Richie was 16, the school principal here asked him to dress up and perform as the school's Indian mascot. It would be the beginning for him of decades of thought and activism about representations of Native Americans. That winter, Richie, who is Menominee and Stockbridge Munsee, went to talk to a tribal elder who offered this advice.
If they want a Hollywood Indian, give them a Hollywood Indian. Don't wear anything sacred.
So Richie borrowed a fake feather headdress.
I had made in Japan moccasins. My little necklace thing was plastic. I even had a rubber tomahawk, you know.
He performed at two home games. The crowd cheered for him. People from the reservation were there to support him. It felt good. Then Richie went with the team to an away game. This time, when he ran out into the gym, people shouted insults.
And then I can specifically remember orange peels, banana peels, and paper cups being thrown at me. Now I back way up. And that's when the guys on the top row start spitting on me. And I just ran into the locker room.
Richie was in tears. The whole experience, he says now, shows the psychological toll the use of Native American mascots can take. By their nature, they reduce people to stereotypes. He says that's why he's still working on this issue 50 years later. And in Wisconsin, that work has recently picked up some momentum. When Washington's NFL team came to Green Bay in December, a group of protesters greeted them at Lambeau Field with drumming and chanting. They carried signs that said Redskins equals racial slur and race-based mascots must go. One member of the group, 14-year-old Isabella Saiz, directly addressed the team's owner, Dan Snyder.
Why do you still believe that this is something that is good for the Native people all around the world? Why do you continue to ignore us when we speak out against it?
The Washington football team is among the most high-profile teams to use a Native American mascot, but there are hundreds of teams across the country that employ Native imagery, including dozens at school districts in Wisconsin. Barbara Munson, who was at the Lambeau Field protest, has been pushing to eliminate Native American mascots since 1997.
Since that time, we've seen 36 Indian mascots change in the state of Wisconsin, and that's really good, but there's still 29 left.
Munson's message to those districts is simple.
Really, it's time for change.
This week, the Wisconsin Association of School Boards is considering a resolution that would call on all Wisconsin school districts to retire their Native American mascots. The resolution was created by WASA School Board President Tricia Zunker. Zunker, who is also running for Congress as a Democrat, cites research showing psychological and educational harm to both Native and non-Native students. And she says the issue affects students in all districts, even those that don't have Native mascots themselves.
It still does affect their perception. It affects their educational experience outside of the classroom.
Plass has seen progress on the issue. Shawnee changed its mascot more than 25 years ago. But he says seeing Native Americans as full human beings means retiring all such mascots.
We're alive. I'm sitting here talking to you. We're a living culture.
The Wisconsin Association of School Boards is taking up the resolution at its annual convention. Rob Menser, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll meet a Wisconsin man who is exonerated after a wrongful conviction and is now joining the Wisconsin bar as an attorney. The class of chemicals called PFAS has been in the news lately with concerns about health risks and pollution. A new WisContext report digs into the chemicals, what they're used for, and why they have health experts worried. And we'll keep up with the latest news in the Senate impeachment trial. That and look at some of the other top news stories of the day. That's coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 7:30, new cases and a new makeup on the U.S. Supreme Court could lead to a new ruling on Roe versus Wade. Kate and her guests look at the latest legal news about abortion. That's tomorrow at 7:30 on The Morning Show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then the state of Virginia passed the Equal Rights Amendment last week, nearly three decades after the deadline to make it part of the U.S. Constitution. We'll talk to a constitutional law expert about the history of the effort and where it goes from here. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.